This storm has caused confusion and delay.
You have caused
confusion and delay.
No, I think you are facing prejudice.
Daisy is just the ultimate thought. Daisy is just the ultimate thought.
Your impatience has caused confusion and delay. This storm has caused confusion and delay. You have caused confusion and
26 years old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive. Bit grey today.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to another Deepest Lore. A little bit later time today, later than usual. But that's because I needed time to get all of the videos together that I wanted to play and to finalize my list here. But before we get going, obviously best way to support this channel, join the channel as a channel member, buy a course at the academic agency, level up your econ knowledge, do the trivium to brush up on your grammar skills. Once you do the trivium, a lot of people have told me they've actually done the trivium and it has helped them immensely at work, in their life in general, just knowing the ABCs, teach you again how to write from the ground up, foundations of rhetoric and logic is also part of the trivium. Many other courses also available. Might as well play an ad at the start here. What ad shall we play? Let's have a look. Well, given that there's a kind of nostalgic element to this stream, why don't I play the original Foundations of Economics ad?
Are you sick of hearing about Marx and Keynes? Do you want to know why neoclassical economics is so flawed? Have you ever wondered how to work out the marginal productivity of a burger bun? Do you want to level up your econ knowledge? Buy it now. £350. Foundations of Economics. Foundations of Economics.
I'm here.
Foundations of Economics. Get it now.
All right. So with all of that said, kind of an interesting stream today. I've compiled my top 10 video essayists, people who are in and around what is typically called the DR, although various problems with that label, but that's what people know it as. And I thought it'd be interesting to think about the video essay as a form. And actually the thing that brought many people to the dance in the first place, I'd suggest that most people found this channel, if it wasn't for one of my famous appearances with Carl, it was probably just stumbling across one of my videos back in the day. Many of the people that we kind of know and love in and around our various communities, we came to through video essays. Now these days, it strikes me that do you remember that old Buggle song, "Video Killed the Radio Star"? It's almost like streaming has killed the video essayist. And certainly, I've been on YouTube a long time now, friends. It's coming up to, 7 years now, or 6 years, whatever. And as time has gone on, of course, the incentives are such that, you're driven to do regular live streams due to super chats, due to the way that the live chat kind of builds up an audience. There are various kind of incentive structures in place, I think, to make the stream the mode of the moment. And that has been the case for the past few years. But back in the day, back in 2016, 2017, I think the mode was the short video essay, the edited video essay, 15, 20 minutes long. Sometimes a long one would be 40 minutes, if at most. And as I was kind of researching, this was a bit of a trip down memory lane, really. I got a bit nostalgic for, you know, remembering, you know, those times. And in a strange way, it was more exciting back then. I mean, yes, it was the sense of discovery and, you know, being introduced to new people and new ideas and so on that many of us were doing. But also, I just think that the scene was more kind of intellectually vibrant when people were making back and forth video essays and video replies. It's actually something that I would like to see return, ideally, even if I understand more than anyone that the incentives are actually against the video essay. I know from my own experience that I can spend 15, 20, 30 hours sometimes working on one 20-minute video, and you know, it comes out and it kind of stalls around 10,000 views or something, whereas you know, my weekly live stream will do more than that. Or even worse, what happens is that I'll spend like 20 hours on one video, nobody watches it. The next day, something will happen in the news. I'll do one off the cuff, takes less than 4 or 5 minutes. That one gets 100,000 views. I've seen that happen so many times. So it's weird how that works. There's a kind of inverse work versus reward thing on YouTube, and it's always been like that for some reason. All of my most viewed videos are my lowest effort videos. A proper video essay takes time and effort. You have to, at the very least, write a script, get some images together, right? Like the old-fashioned video essay was, you'd write a script to read and you'd get images and you put the images together with your words, okay? But obviously, there's a lot more you can do with it. You can have clips, you can have moving images, you can have, I mean, you can get pretty high concept with a video essay. And I think there's a real art to it. It's not the same as writing an essay on Substack. And that's where a lot of, I think, the more vibrant intellectual energy has gone in this day and age, is onto Substack. That's where a lot of the people, I think, who made their names as video essayists in this scene now are just straight up just writing essays on Substack. Okay. So what I was gonna do on this really is to kind of reappreciate the video essay as a form, and then think about like who made the really good ones. Okay, now I obviously have not ranked myself. I have not put myself in my own top 10. I'm not actually sure, even if I did it objectively, if I would make a top 10. I'm not sure if the video essay was my forte. I had a couple of good ones back in the day. I think my Boomer Truth series stands up pretty well. But a lot of my old videos, I think, are pretty stats heavy, you know. I mean, I had different modes. I had a kind of Adam Curtis mode that I do sometimes, and then I'd have a more kind of stato, kind of dry stats attack. Probably the Adam Curtis ones have held up a bit better. But they take so much time and effort to do those videos. And I think I've only got a handful of them in my own back catalogue of videos. So my selection criteria really was the actual content of the stuff, obviously, how well written it is, you know, how much they make you think and how much they kind of get you to think about fundamental things. And then I've given other points for style, kind of some people have flash, right? You can have flash in the video essay, flair, things like that. So I've given you know, I've kind of tried to choose people who have, you know, pretty solid skills in one or all of those areas. Although, as we'll see, some people get carried more by the flash, other people get carried more more by the just the fundamental quality of their writing, if that makes any sense. There's a lot to get through. I also want to play a lot of these, like I want to feature some of the old videos to take a bit of a trip down memory lane here. Although I won't be able to play all of them because some of them are like 20, 30 minutes long, but we'll watch enough to get a feel. Okay. Anything else to say about the video essay? I think that something else about the video essay is that the live stream as a form is a bit more intimate, is a bit more personal, it's a bit more, you kind of get to know the person, quote unquote. Whereas the video essay, at least back in the day when people had persona, there was a bit more, because there's a craft to it, there was a bit more of a mystique around the person, right? Because very often it was sealed names, you just got a voice or an avatar, not a lot of people showed their faces, 4 or 5 years ago, and so there was something, it was like a different thing, if that makes any sense. Even people who follow this channel for a long time probably have a different sense of, you know, me as the live streamer and me as just the kind of voice they heard on the 10-minute videos back in the day. So it's kind of a bit of that I miss in a strange way. And I got a bit nostalgic about it all. But anyway, let me start my list now. In fact, I need to find my list. Hold on a second. I posted it earlier on and I've lost it now. I forgot to save the Word file. So I need to find my own screen grab of it. Hold on a minute. okay, we're going to make a start. Let's make a start. So at number 10, now if you thought my old videos were sometimes a bit dry and stats heavy, there was somebody who was the absolute king of the stat attack back in the day. He's still around, I think. I think his channel's called something else these days. And that is, of course, Alt Hype. Alt Hype was just so good at providing the kind of raw data that you needed to construct basically any argument. And it doesn't matter how difficult the subject, somehow he'd find the data on it and he'd talk you through the data and the logic of the data. Now I've ranked him as number 10 because, as you'll see, you know, he had a kind of dry and factual style, but pretty much every video of his, at least back in the day, in my view, was kind of vital viewing and was kind of important, I think, for, not just me, probably lots of people at coming to some of their conclusions. The video I've picked out, and I would say Alt Hype is associated much more with the kind of race and IQ stuff. I've never been that interested in the whole IQ issue for various different reasons. I just think it's a kind of IQ, but I think there are deeper, more profound issues than simply IQ, spiritual matters, the matter of a kind of spirit of a people, the culture, soul of a people, and things like that. So I've actually picked out another video of his that I think readers of Populist Delusion will recognize the study that he's talking through here. So let's have a little look at Alt Hype.
So there was a paper from 2014 that faced some criticism, testing theories of American politics, elites, interest groups, and average citizens. And they looked at 1,779 policy changes from 1981 to 2002. In 2015, Martin Gillens did a follow-up where he looked at 2,245 policy changes from 1964 to 2006. And what these guys found was that policy changes were driven entirely by elite opinion and to a lesser extent, by special interest opinion. According to them, average citizens' preference had almost no effect on policy change. Whether the average citizens 90% opposed a policy or 90% supported a policy, it still had about a 30% chance of happening. With economic elites, the story is radically different. If they all oppose something, it doesn't pass. If they all support it, it'll have a roughly 60% chance of getting passed. For interest groups, the important effects are around the middle, when interest groups began to net support a change. There were, of course, rebuttals to this. The main criticism was that median income Americans won 47% of the time. And as far as I'm aware, this is true, and Martin Gillens did not challenge this figure. But how can this be the case, and at the same time, this graph showing no apparent impact of average citizen opinion? How can this also be true? Well, the reason for this is thresholds. If 51% of average Americans support X and 49% of elites also support X, and X gets passed, then that's coded as the average citizens overpowering the elites, because the elites net oppose that. On the other hand, if 25% of average Americans support Y, but 75% of elites support Y, and then Y gets passed, that's then coded as the elites overpowering the average Americans, so that's one win for them. So, given these two events, it's one and one, right? The average Americans and the elites are each winning about half the time, right? Of course, doing a straight win-loss criteria is grossly misleading, as it hides the margins on each issue and doesn't fully capture the power rating of each group. What Gillens did was take a threshold, comparing instances in which 75% of elites or 75% of middle income people either supported or opposed a law. The first comparison was looking at policies they supported. When the affluent strongly favor a change, but the middle income doesn't strongly favor the change, it gets passed 55% of the time. If both the affluent and the middle income strongly favor something, it gets adopted 49% of the time, which would indicate a negative effect of middle income support. The same thing is seen when the affluent don't strongly support something. If the middle income also don't strongly support it, it gets passed 29% of the time. But if the middle income do strongly support a measure and the affluent strongly oppose it, it only gets passed 24% of the time. Again, indicating a negative impact of middle class support on an issue. Looking the other way, you see the impact of affluent support on something being between 26 points and 25 points. So the policies that get passed, or at least got passed between 1980 and 2002, were those that the rich supported and the middle class did not support. The same story can be seen in terms of killing policies that each group opposes. If the affluent strongly oppose a policy, but the middle class doesn't strongly oppose it, it's only adopted 4% of the time. If the affluent strongly oppose and the middle class also strongly opposes a policy, it gets adopted 15% of the time. If the affluent don't strongly oppose something and neither does the middle class, it gets adopted 34% of the time. If the affluent don't strongly oppose something, but the middle class does strongly oppose it, it gets adopted 40% of the time. Again, indicating a negative impact of middle class preference on policy that gets adopted. A follow-up was done in 2015, which...
All right, so I think that's enough from all type. You kind of understand that he was very good at really getting underneath the data, breaking things, like not only introducing you to the data, but talking you through its logic. And you know, he was extremely thorough at that sort of thing. You know, he put the A into autism, I would say. So I had to include him in my top 10 here. Now, I should say that I reviewed quite a lot of old videos. And in my view, there were some people who I kind of went into it thinking would make it. And then I was kind of looking back over their old vids and thinking, not sure how well some of these have aged, or not quite sure about this thing or that thing. So there were some people who, upon reviewing, I decided not to include. And there were other people who, upon reviewing, I thought, actually, they were really good, weren't they? So, yeah, there are also many friends, current friends, old friends who, you know, there's only 10 slots. So there's lots of people who, you know, what, you know, just I wasn't able to include everybody, obviously. The other thing I'll say is that Bowden, who I'm seeing getting mentioned in the chat, Bowden wasn't really a video essayist. He was an orator. He was great at giving speeches. And that is a different skill set. It's a different skill set altogether than making the video essay. So Bowden is not one of the 10 either. So it's a surprise, surprise. So let us now move on to the next person. And again, I don't necessarily agree with everything all of these people say. I'm purely doing it as a kind of who were the people who just made the best videos, okay? And my next selection is actually Mark Brahman, who these days tends to hang out with Dickie Spencer on that little podcast they do together, and is quite esoteric and so on. Back in the day, you may remember him as the voice on various songs by, was it Xurious or Xurious? But he actually made a number of interesting and visually arresting video essays as well, something he was calling REM theory. And you know, let's just have a little watch of one of Brahman's REM videos.
Before we discuss this perhaps exotic idea of Apolloism, some viewers might wonder, why not Christianity? Why isn't a return to Christian worship the answer to our civilizational crisis? After all, if the West is to continue in any salubrious form, or indeed rejuvenate itself and attain even greater heights, should it not seek to return to the faith Europeans held for the last 1600 years? A faith that became familiar to them, that became, in many ways, integral to their very identity. Perhaps the first and most obvious question, is Christianity true? Most Christians take the miracles depicted in the New Testament as factual events that occurred, and moreover, that belief in the reality of miracles, especially the resurrection of Jesus, is requisite for being a Christian. In contrast, REM theorists understand the miracles described in the New Testament to be fictions, symbolic or parabolic in meaning, with no real plausibility or historical truth to them. For this reason, REM theorists consider Christ at best a semi-mythical figure, perhaps modeled on a historical figure, but inescapably based in part on earlier dying and rising gods. On the simple premise alone, that the miracles depicted in the New Testament are fictitious, REM theorists argue, Christianity must be understood as false according to its own criteria. The second and perhaps far more important question is whether Christianity, regardless of the historicity of its miracles, is of value to Western civilization. To be clear, this is a question separate from whether or not religion in general is of value. Indeed, REM theorists do believe religion and theism of a particular type are necessary to cohere a civilization to a common purpose and to point it in a common eugenic direction. Proponents of Christianity as a constructive civilizational force would argue that it was Christianity's system of values, in particular, that led to the amazing success of Western civilization. REM theorists, on the other hand, would argue that values that allowed the West to succeed were already present among pagan ancestors, such as the Romans. There, REM theorists argue, the entire society was built on reverence of the familia and gens, or family and race, the celestial gods in particular, such as Jupiter, Juno, Mars, Apollo, and Diana, represented common ancestral gods by which all the Romans were cohered as a distinct people descended of a particular gens. In light of Edward Gibbon's view that Christianity was itself instrumental to the fall of Rome, we might see Christianity, the most subtle of the Thonic cults, as having succeeded in overthrowing Rome's celestial chieftain gods.
All right, so I mean, I'm not going to play all of these videos. I just want to kind of give you a flavor of their general kind of flair and style. And I would say that whether you agree or disagree with Brahman's central thesis that he's developing, he has a lot of flair, right? I mean, there's a lot of flair in that. And he has a kind of interesting rhetorical delivery, kind of oratory style. In his voice. So the reason that Brahman is quite, is not like higher up the list is that I don't know how many videos he's not that prolific. So there's only like a handful of those that he ever made that I can remember. But, you know, they were extreme effort posts, let's just say. Now, let us carry on. Because the next person that I have listed at number 8 in the list is my old friend Charlemagne. Now, I don't know why and one of the things I noticed, by the way, is that there was a kind of high point in video essays around 2019, 2020. And I don't know whether it was COVID or whether it was the introduction of super chats or what. But many, many of these people either stopped making video essays, like Charlie's still around, but he mainly does have Substack now, doesn't really make video essays, or he appears on streams. Some of them got banned in various great ban waves, you know, before the during COVID, 2020 election, before 2020. There were various ban waves, if you can remember. So some of these people have been banned straight off YouTube. But I noticed that even when they've gone over to other platforms, few of them have continued to make video essays. So it's a kind of shame in a way, because these people are, like, in my view, a lot of these people have talent in this form, but for whatever reason, they just kind of feel disinclined. And I get it. I mean, trust me, I get it myself, why people don't, you know, want to spend, like, you know, 30 hours making something that, you know, maybe 10,000 people will watch, maybe less than 10,000 people will watch, you know, at most, like 30,000 people will watch it. So anyway, let's have a look at one of Charlemagne's old classics. This one is short enough that I may play it in full. This is No Exit by Charlie back in the day.
Yo, we'll take a brief look at a clip from a video titled Undisciplining, Defending the Social. This is a video of a small recorded lecture from June 21st, 2018. Settlers Lament sent this to me a few months ago, and the particular segment I want to show you is something I've had in the back of my mind for a while. There are important extrapolations we can make from it, and these are particularly important to make right now. So, let's watch the clip.
Patry Friedman is the grandson of Milton Friedman, for instance. And Patry Friedman, at the moment, is busy using Peter Thiel's billions of pounds to build seasteads, island states, ships moored together in international waters, where democracy does not pertain, exit is the only human right in the exit voice loyalty strategy. These places to be governed by CEOs, or worse, monarchs, and not regulated.
The facts that he states are self-explanatory. It is the verbally unsaid intention that is the most interesting. What does he really mean in these words? Firstly, he expresses clear spite at the idea of Peter Thiel's billions of pounds. Perhaps he cannot tolerate any one man having such wealth at all. At the very least, he cannot tolerate someone outside of the progressive thought regime possessing such wealth, which translates to power. Next, he shows his attitude towards these floating island city-states. There are four facts about them that he cannot tolerate. First, that these places are undemocratic. Second, that they offer only one human right, exit. Third, he cannot tolerate authority in these places being vested in a single person, either a CEO or a monarch. Fourth, that these places are unregulated. A critical examination of these statements reveals the disturbing intentions of this man, and using him as a proxy, of leftists generally. What do the leftists mean by this complaint of undemocratic? What they really mean, beneath this formalism of democracy, is that there is no certain means by which the people may implement fairness by socializing power and property out of the hands of the powerful and the wealthy by force. Why the insistence on expanding human rights beyond exit? Again, exit is intolerable as a solution to unfairness because it does not involve the redistribution of power and property by force. This shows that the real concern is not for ordinary people leading happy lives. If this were the real concern, then exit would be a perfectly acceptable solution. No. The insistence on human rights is again merely a formalism to hide the real intent to disempower competitors by force. Once something is democratically taken away from those competitors, that state of affairs is then instantiated as a human right, so that it becomes impossible for the thing that was taken to be reappropriated by its prior possessor. Why the aversion to a CEO, or worse, a monarch, ruling in these territories? Although a CEO and a monarch are interchangeable in this circumstance, he is particularly spiteful towards monarchs because they are the ancient enemy of the liberal, whereas the CEO is tolerable under certain conditions, that is to say, socialized conditions. What do the leftists mean by this complaint of unregulated? The nature of the complaint is really as to the nature of sovereignty. The leftist seems to despise authority, but a deeper analysis shows that this is not the case. The leftist hides their desire for authoritarian power by insisting that power should not be vested in a single ruler. Of course, monarchical power has always been localized. Never has there been or even been the idea of a global monarch or emperor over the entire world. The leftist does, in fact, seek global government. They conceal this by corporatizing power, but nevertheless, they insist on a unified global sovereign. The difference between right and left on this matter is that the right seeks secure, responsible, and effective government, whereas the left seeks universalism. This is the key observation to make, the most important thing I wanted to point out. What this guy is actually complaining about is a voluntarist community of a few large ships tied together in the middle of the ocean and living in their own way, bothering no one. It is not even some existing place being altered into a neo-cameralist state. It is an entirely new place. What we on the right must understand is that the left ultimately will tolerate no place being outside of their control. The very idea that somewhere there is a place that is not democratic deeply disturbs universalists. To a conservative person, it might seem utterly absurd to imagine that left-wingers will bother asserting themselves deliberately on some faraway cabin in the middle of nowhere that is doing no harm to anyone, but we just heard the man say that this is exactly their intent. A right-winger might think that they can find a place remote enough to be outside of the interest of leftists, but there is no such place. If a ship town in the middle of the ocean is an insufficient escape, then surely there is no place on land that is remote enough to escape their interest. Now, the expression of intent does not necessarily mean that the intent will be actualized, but it is important to realize that they do wish they could actualize totalitarian control over even the most remotest places on Earth. We must therefore do whatever we can to avoid their wrath, and we can examine what they tend to attack and what they tend to ignore to help us here. Anything within the sovereignty of a hostile power is automatically more at risk. This means anything in the United States especially, but also Western European countries. In the domain of those powers, anything that is culturally neutral tends to be ignored. Groups such as Mormons and Amish fall into this category. Mormonism is something of a joke, and the Amish have no cultural impact whatsoever. These are therefore safe for the left to tolerate. It is even possible that communities like this could last for a long time. But if they ever attempted to affect the broader culture, they would be ruthlessly dealt with. Christianity is not a joke, and is a proselytizing religion, so it is treated with more hostility. Anything with weaponry is automatically elevated in threat, such as Waco. The regime is extremely sensitive to even the slightest possibility of physical resistance, as I mentioned in my recent blog post on Substack, linked in the description. This is why the US Capitol was so extensively militarized following January 6th. So, self-defense within Western countries has more to do with being, or at least appearing to be, culturally neutral, and not having any significant quantity of weapons. Outside of hostile regimes, self-defense has more to do with physical protection than it does ideological, where potential threats are not hegemonic empires, but smaller, more localized threats. When pursuing their interests, right-wingers must recognize which types of actions generate aggro from the left, and also where it is safer to pursue those interests. Thanks for watching.
So there's Charlemagne. I mean, let me just go through some of the things I always liked about Charlemagne when he did his video essays. He was always to the point, no bullshit, no faff whatsoever. Brilliant, concise writing style. I have always liked Charlie's intensity. He's intense. And okay, he has that slightly kind of autistic timbre in his voice, but I kind of like that element about him. He's kind of got a bit of edge about him. The other thing I liked about him is that he always brings kind of good and unique insights. And, you know, starting it with that speech of the guy talking about these imaginary cities out like in the middle of the ocean was a brilliant way in to make this kind of, you know, more profound point. So Charlie was very good at that. And it was definitely, I think, in the elite tier of video makers. That's why he's in my top 10. So moving up the list now to number 7. And I think this is one of the first ones who's actually been outright banned on YouTube. But I had to include him because he has got brilliant core skills in terms of the actual video making. And he also addresses areas, he focuses on an area, namely video games, that a lot of the other kind of big name video essayists back in the day kind of didn't really touch for whatever reason. And that is, of course, American Krogan. Let's watch a little bit of the epilogue of his famous BioShock series.
In essence, BioShock Infinite's narrative takes players on a distorted journey of American history and then concludes that, even in a world of infinite possibilities, there remain constants and variables. The details may change, but, as Noel Ignatiev once said,
there can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacy. If you abolish slavery, you abolish.
The entire unfolding of the game was designed specifically to arouse feelings of hatred toward Comstock, the white supremacist effigy, and then reveal to the player that they are, in fact, that very effigy. At which point the player is meant to entertain the idea that, to save the rest of humanity from his sinful nature, he should cease to exist. Now, do I think very many people came away from the game with this interpretation? No, I don't. I think this pretty much went over everyone's head, almost entirely. It was so grotesque, so alien, so hostile, that it simply didn't register on most people's radar. A word that comes to mind here, once again, is chutzpah. On the other hand, of course, Ken Levine inserted a lot of narrative mechanisms for plausible deniability as well. Centrist altists here will invariably focus on how the series supposedly suggests equal fanaticism and guilt on everyone's part, while they ignore that Daisy Fitzroy wasn't drowned in a baptismal font in the end, and Andrew Ryan wasn't nailed to a cross and repeatedly stabbed with a giant syringe by a Jew. To be sure, there was some controversy surrounding the game when it first came out. Much of it centered on the forced baptism, which, ironically, made Christians upset, precisely because forced baptisms actually go against their beliefs. Still, one Christian asserted that BioShock Infinite was actually the most deeply Christian game he had played in recent memory. He goes through some motions about how baptism is about spiritual death and rebirth, while at the same time he completely undermines the idea that there can be meaningful redemption through baptism. He actually ends the article by calling Ken Levine a prophet. Quote, My own spiritual journey has led me to believe that the mysterious universal that we recklessly refer to as God is far more inclusive than I had ever fathomed. And yet, the road to redemption is a road that leads, perhaps, to a type of death. Ken Levine has, in many ways, failed to craft the perfect game, but I believe he has done something even more important. He has spoken as a prophet, unquote. Naturally, as you might imagine, I don't agree with him here, but I do agree with him about something else he stated earlier when acknowledging the game's plot holes and shortcomings. Quote, "But what if it was not about constructing a watertight plot at all? What if the entire game was constructed in order to bring us to a single moment? What would we find in that moment?" Unquote. Well, in my opinion, the game was entirely constructed to bring us to a single moment, and that moment was your death. And no, I don't think it was some kind of spiritual transformation. The game was stating outright that your path to redemption is death because you have no path to redemption. No matter what you choose to do, as Booker DeWitt or Zachary Comstock or the player, the outcome causes others to suffer. And as far as the mechanics, or presentation rather, of this outcome goes, Comstock, that is DeWitt, that is the player, was convinced to voluntarily accept this outcome. Now, with this in
mind... Oh, I mean, you get the general kind of vibe of Krogan style there. I might as well list some of the things that I think, you know, made him worthy of inclusion on the list. Obviously, he's a skilled video editor. Obviously, he has a kind of, you know, there's a good style to the videos. But I think that Krogan has something else, which is deep research skills, really deep research skills. And I say that as somebody who basically doesn't rate anybody's research apart from my own. But he has got really good, strong, deep research skills, and he brings them to bear in unexpected ways. Like, how can I put this? If there was something I couldn't find, I would go to great lengths. Like, I'd actually go to an actual kind of physical reference library or something, you know, if I was really desperate to find it. And I know for a fact that Krogan would also do that. He guys kind of goes above and beyond when it comes to finding info. And I think even in that clip that you saw there, you know, he had read every interview. He'd kind of really gone way over what you'd expect, you know, for a video essay of this type. So, his research, I think, is a huge part of what makes him good. Another part of it is the kind of esoteric depth to his readings. This is kind of a lot of the stuff he's talking about in these games is under the surface. It's esoteric. The only other person I can think of who even gets close to that level of truly understanding what's going on when it comes to breaking down texts written by people from a certain group would be Mark Brahman, who I mentioned earlier on. Mark Brahman also has some superb readings of the films and things like that. So I would say the combination of those things there, the basic video essay skills, plus the research, plus the ability to see the kind of underneath the surface stuff, really, I think, is where his values are. Where his value is and why he made the list. Okay. So next person on the list, and again, this is somebody who's still around, but they tend not to do video essays anymore. They tend now to focus on doing streams, although this person's streams are still typically solo and straight to camera. So they are kind of essay-ish, but that is Vox Day. Now, again, he might not be to everybody's cup of tea, but back in the day, Vox Day made some of the best videos going. So let's have a little watch of one of his.
Vox Day. Today, we're going to delve deeper into the socio-sexual hierarchy. Last time we talked about alphas, Now we're going to talk about the lower end of the hierarchy, specifically the rank known as the gamma. Just a quick refresher, the socio-sexual hierarchy has five primary ranks: alpha, beta, delta, gamma, and omega. The gamma is possibly the most interesting socio-sexual rank and behavioral pattern in the entire hierarchy. This is because gammas are among the people with the most undeveloped potential in the socio-sexual hierarchy. Let's talk about what the characteristics of a gamma are. We know that they tend to be low status, but they're not complete social outcasts. They tend to be unattractive to women. They tend to be more intelligent than the norm. They tend to be overweight. They also tend to be subject matter experts. If you think about the average individual who is overly obsessive with regards to a particular hobby, that is almost certainly going to be a gamma. You may recall the movie from the 1980s called The Revenge of the Nerds. That movie is a gamma wish fulfillment movie that describes what life looks like from the gamma perspective. In fact, you see a lot of this in Hollywood. You see a lot of this in science fiction. These are some of the best places to get a unrestrained glimpse into the gamma psychology, because it's where people are, where people who are gammas are communicating their view of the world without trying to conceal it from you. Because one of the biggest characteristics of the gamma, and probably the most important one, the most definitive one, is their habitual dishonesty. Gammas tend to be very, very dishonest, both with themselves and others. Remember, this isn't primarily about rank. This isn't primarily about status, even though that is what people tend to focus on. What it's primarily about is the behavioral pattern, and there's no group that it is more important to be able to understand, identify, and anticipate than the gamma. If you've ever been on a internet site where there are comments, whether it's YouTube, a blog, whatever, you can almost identify the gammas simply by the number of words they use in a post. Because if you see a long post, you're going to see a lot of the very behavior that I'm describing. You see the posturing. You see the assumptions of superiority. You will see the assumption of an ability to not only judge the other person, but even discern their motivations and, if necessary, read their minds. And the one thing that you will always see is the need to declare victory no matter what happens. It's very, very difficult and very painful, I think, for the gamma. If I had one thing, just one thing, that I could convince every gamma in the world, it's this: you're not fooling anyone. Even when you think you're fooling yourself, even when you are fooling yourself, you're not actually fooling us. What I'm talking about here is the protective bubble of delusion that gammas erect over time around themselves to protect their feelings. Because what you're dealing with here is people who have had to deal with a long and painful process of one rejection after another after another. If there's one thing that summarizes the gamma attitude more than any other, it's that I could have been successful had I wanted to. Because the gamma is always conflict avoidant and is also failure avoidant. The problem, of course, is you cannot live and avoid failure. Everybody fails sooner or later. Most of us fail on a regular basis. Doesn't matter whether it's an online argument or asking a girl out for a date or applying to a university, going to a job interview. You can't live without doing those things. But the pain of dealing with repeated failure is one reason why gammas so often retreat to their delusion bubble, where they can declare themselves victors all the time. Gammas also tend to be highly, highly romantic. They're really into the big gesture. They're convinced that how much you like a woman matters with regards to whether she should be attracted to you or not. And that's why you'll often hear gammas talk about girls that they like who are interested in other guys as if the other guys are somehow ensorcelling her. They're somehow tricking her, misleading her, deceiving her. And if only she knew how much he liked her, then she'd be interested. But it's not how a man treats a woman that determines how attractive he is to her. And that's one thing that the gammas tend to struggle with tremendously. Whenever you have a very attractive woman who, for no apparent reason, and without any warning, and without any indication of interest in the male protagonist, inexplicably begins a sexual relationship with him, which of course takes him completely by surprise. And from that moment on, the couple is together forever. That is the gamma ideal, because gammas are fundamentally passive. They're passive aggressive, they're conflict avoidant, and they don't believe in pursuing women. In fact, they have an almost complete lack of understanding of women, which is kind of surprising because a lot of their behavioral patterns and thought patterns tend to be somewhat feminine in nature. In fact, there are some who actually describe the gamma as a female mind in a male body. So it's a little bit strange that they seem to be so inept when it comes to understanding and anticipating women. But women tend to be a vast mystery to the gamma. They don't know how to behave around women, especially not women that they're attracted to. And when they do finally summon up the courage to pursue them, they usually do so in such an over-the-top, inept way that it doesn't work very well. I should probably mention that women have gamma radar like you would not believe. If you're not sure about whether someone's a gamma or not, just ask a moderately attractive girl who knows them, because women react negatively to gammas as if they're radioactive. A number of women have told me that they actually feel the urge to physically punch gammas in the face, just instinctively. So what are the practical aspects? From a male point of view, the first thing that you need to understand about the gammas is that they are almost always disruptive to your organization. And we have a lot of projects that we do, whether it's Voxiversity stuff, whether it's Castalia House stuff, whether it's Arkhaven stuff. We probably have 30 to 35 volunteers in various capacities with various responsibilities. You know, one thing that I had to learn to do is to stop accepting people who were volunteering to help. And the reason was, the more enthusiastic someone was about contacting me and wanting to help, I eventually discovered the more likely it was that they were a gamma. What would
All right. I mean, it carries on going on, but you kind of get the idea. So, I mean, I did notice a lot of people kind of instinctively reacted against that. To me, it's just self-evidently true. It's just obviously true. All of this stuff is clearly self-evidently, observationally true. And all Vox has done is codified something that exists in the world. I mean, you all know this guy. You all know this guy. And if you don't know this guy, or if you're instinctively reacting against it, you probably are that guy. So in terms of why have I rated Vox, he has a very clear way of articulating himself, does have this kind of slow kind of speech pattern, but he's quite good at articulating exactly what a concept is, defining it well. He kind of, I think Vox has some sort of background in whether it's formal or informal, he has some sort of philosophy background, I seem to remember. He certainly studied like ancient rhetoric and so on. So he's quite good at explaining his concepts in a very clear way. Vox has also got something that I think is an underrated skill, basically, which is coining a phrase. I am actually very good at doing this. I have so many phrases, you know, back to Fresh Prince and Boomer Truth Regime, and you know, you all know my little slogans and phrases. Aaron McIntyre is fantastic at this on Twitter as well. But Vox has also always been very good at coining a phrase. You know, Day of the Pillow is one of Vox days, for example. And you know, he's got others as well. But his categories here in the psychosexual hierarchy are also a good example of it, and you'll casually see these terms used, you know, around the place. So that is why I have ranked Vox Day. So next one in the list, this is number five now. Vox was number six. This is number five, is Vertigo Politics. And I had to search far and wide for one that I felt comfortable playing here on YouTube, because I believe he is another one who may have been banned. But undoubtedly, one of the top five video essayists of all time in whatever this thing is. So,
a few months ago, London's Walking and Cycling Commissioner stated that cycling had become too white and was deeply concerned about the lack of gender and racial diversity among the operators of two-wheeled pedal-powered conveyances. As a consequence, actual diversity quotas are seriously being considered to address the glaring absence of women, Muslims, and people of color on their bicycles in Britain. This follows a dangerous trend in which whites are the only group that government can interrogate and critically scrutinize whenever more than one of them seems to be enjoying themselves. The basic theory is, if more than two white people are engaged in some kind of hobby, it is in dire need of diversity, and the simple presence of whites will somehow scare all the people of color away. We could probably critique the strange phenomena of implicit racial bias towards white people going completely unremarked, as if it's just natural to fear the All-Aryan Bowling League. Clearly, if we were talking about white people feeling intimidated by a large presence of blacks, that would imply racism, but the converse is never true. In this case, the Mamil menace, in which cycling is dominated by white middle-aged men in Lycra, policymakers are scratching their heads as if the ethnic homogeneity is evidence of some vast racist conspiracy. It makes one wonder if these idiots really believe that there are violent skinhead cyclist gangs silently cruising on their overpriced carbon fiber road bikes looking for blacks to beat up with their bicycle pumps. Are we really supposed to believe that women and minority groups are somehow intimidated by gangly cardio fags wearing skin-tight lycra? This isn't a new phenomenon. Just try a little experiment and type any random activity into Google followed by the phrase too white or unbearable whiteness, and observe the frantic hand-wringing over how every facet of life suffers from an inundation of demelanated colonizers. Wistful introspection and navel-gazing commences the very instant someone observes a proportionately appropriate number of honkies engaged in virtually any sort of enterprise. Can't go running, work as a librarian, play video games, or swing a fucking tennis racket without the social justice inquisition dissecting you for racism. The levels of absurdity achieved by this analysis reach the point of self-parody, as in the white supremacist implications based on the color white itself. Accepting the one obvious counterexample of a non-white group being scrutinized for overrepresentation, you can't get a fair analysis of something that the most brain-dead normie would immediately think of. This phenomena is just the logical corollary of assuming that white people do not have a culture, completely invalidating the concept whites could ever have distinct pursuits in the first place. It's all part of a blatant delegitimization of an entire race of people, which according to the very own sociological theory is the very first thing someone does to a suspect class before brutally oppressing them. despite bicycles originating in Europe and professional bike racing evolving as a pursuit of white European men, this is not in any way perceived as a natural pastime for that ethnic group in the same way that jazz music and fatally shooting people over their sneakers is widely accepted as authentic black culture. Apparently, if a white man is engaged in something, he is at best functioning as a placeholder until a more worthy group comes along, and at worst is actively blocking the POCs entitled to this hobby. This is what anti-white propaganda looks like. It is real, it is dangerous, and the hostile liberal elite is consciously trying to delegitimize whiteness. They're effectively denying whites any avenue for personal satisfaction, but more importantly, this will act as a prelude to real genocide.
So that was Vertigo Politics. I'm just trying to include why I think they're good. I think that of the people we've had so far, he's probably the best writer, like in terms of his script. He wrote extremely tight scripts with brilliant turns of phrases. Like Charlemagne, he's pretty concise. He has that intensity about him that I kind of like. And the thing is with Vertigo, it was all killer, no filler, right? I mean, straight to the point, straight to the heart of a matter. You could basically pick up Vertigo Politics' back catalog, watch all those videos in the space of 2 or 3 days, and that would be, you know, you'd overdose on the old red pills. There's just, I mean, every single video has got something that... you know, if you didn't already know it, it would be kind of reinforce what you already know. So he was great. He has many, many good videos. That one I picked because I thought I could play it, right? Some of his stuff goes hard, as the kids say, goes hard, right? I'd strongly recommend if you haven't seen all his old, I think they're either back up on YouTube or they've been archived somewhere. But a lot of his stuff is I consider essential. And certainly, again, in terms of my own, you know, intellectual journey, these are some of the people who he was one of the people I would say who any kind of liberal priors I had were gone by the time I'd, you know, fully ingested what he was saying. Yeah, and I don't know if he, of all of the people, ever did like streams. I've never heard him as a guest, or he's a very mysterious character to me. I don't know who he is, one of the most mystical of the people. He still has that mystique about him, as far as I'm concerned, because I think he came back once or twice quietly. But he's just always made brilliant videos. So he was. Number 5 on the list. Now, with the next person I've picked, number 4, is a buddy of mine, someone I've known for a long time, consider him a friend, met him in real life. He was at the event earlier this year. I'm not like in daily contact with him, but I've always kind of respected everything he does. Don't agree with all of his take. I don't necessarily agree with any of the things that these people say, but I agree with a lot of his stuff. It was difficult to showcase a single essay from this individual. I'm talking about Dave. I'm talking about the Distributist. I'm going to make a strange analogy here. Back in the day, when I was watching, when you'd be watching WWF wrestling, whenever Greg Valentine would come into the ring, Gorilla Monsoon on commentary would always make the same comment. He'd say, oh, well, the thing about Greg Valentine is it takes him about 15 minutes to warm up, right? Because he was known for having long matches, you know, hour-long matches or 30-minute matches or whatever. And this is very much Dave, right? He takes... one of his essays, it takes time to unfurl, and he kind of sets the scene, and he takes it takes him about 15 minutes to warm up. And obviously, I'm just playing clips on this show, so it's kind of difficult to get the essence of what makes him so good in a short clip. But going through his back catalogue, I've picked out one where I think it kind of showcases why he's such a unique voice and why, you know, I think he's a kind of valued member of the community, always thoughtful. So let's play one of Dave's best here. This video is called Nostalgia and Cozy. So let's have a little listen.
As part of the video essay, I'm going to begin by talking about one of the worst deals I've ever made in my entire adult life. And then, for whatever it's worth, my personal cope. As I've mentioned in previous videos, during high school I was competitively involved in the game Magic the Gathering, being lucky enough to get in on the game at the ground level. By the time I finished high school and eventually put the game away, I had a fairly impressive collection. Not really wanting anything more to do with the game, I put the cards away for almost a decade, until later, in my mid-20s, when perusing a local game shop for a new Euro game, I happened to come across a price list for Magic the Gathering cards, and I was shocked. Cards that were worth tens of dollars when I remembered playing the game were now worth hundreds. And that didn't even seem possible, not for a tiny piece of cardboard at least. How could a market this high for playing cards even be sustainable? Thinking that I was in some kind of bizarre market price spike, some type of Amsterdam tulip market bizarro world, I resolved then and there to sell the lion's share of my collection. After all, how could it get any higher? What, are people going to be paying thousands of dollars for a piece of cardboard? I remember walking out of the game shop with an enormous cashier's check, feeling like I was the smartest person in the world. But even at this moment, I wasn't entirely oblivious. I understood that there was a sentimental attachment to these collector's items. I was well aware of all the horror stories of people selling their comic book collections and then not really knowing what they had done with the money. The last thing I wanted was to have this new windfall just dissolve into the air, dissolve into the living expenses that just came along with being a 26-year-old. At once, upon getting the money, I decided that I needed to buy something that had some sentimental value, but that was longer lasting, something that would have class and staying power, and just feel like a better and more adult investment than a series of playing cards. And so, with a good portion of the money I got, I sat down and bought this, a refurbished 19th century violin, built before, could you believe it, the American Civil War. Of course, this was not the highest quality instrument. Despite being old, it was something of a beater, and I already had a much nicer violin from the 20th century that I used for most of my playing, which was predominantly American folk music. Still, I liked the idea of having this violin as an alternate. At the time, I really enjoyed attending music festivals and old-time festivals where people camped and played in the evenings, and it was nice to have a marginally less expensive instrument that I could take to those gatherings, especially since its age made it so much of a conversation piece. The instrument was beautiful, for lack of a better word, and as I packed it up and took it home, I felt that there was no way that I would ever regret this deal. Well, wouldn't you know it? Fast forward 7 or 8 years, and financially, this deal was terrible. Those vintage Magic the Gathering cards, the ones worth hundreds that I never thought could be worth thousands, well, it turns out that they are worth thousands now. An appreciation on these cards well above 600%. And, in case you're wondering, there has been no such similar appreciation on antique, low-grade instruments, least of all old violins from the early 19th century. And while I do thoroughly enjoy having an alternative violin, post-grad school and post-family, big expeditions to folk festivals weren't really a thing for me anymore. Whereas the Magic the Gathering collection I had sold to obtain the violin, if liquidated at current market prices, probably would have covered a significant portion of the down payment on my house. In any objective terms, this was a bad deal. But before I go ahead and kick myself too hard for all the money I could have made, I will say this, I don't actually regret the exchange. Of course, there's the raw financial difference that at this stage is quite hard to ignore, but in another sense, in another objective sense, I think it's just nicer to own the old violin than a set of Magic the Gathering playing cards. I know this sounds like a cope, and in some ways it kind of is, but it also gets to an emotion that I'm trying to put into words, an expression about the quality of the violin, and the quality of its alternative. It's not simply that the violin is beautiful, which it certainly is. It's not even that I have sentimental attachment to the violin. From a strictly autobiographical point of view, I had more attachment to the cards. Still, while the Magic the Gathering cards might have reflected more of myself, more of my past life, I think the violin reflects more of humanity, more of the world in general, more of a beauty beyond my own personality. The Magic the Gathering playing cards were certainly, for me, nostalgic, and that's certainly why they sold for so much money. But the violin, despite its low price tag, is something more. The violin is cozy.
Do you see what I mean, by the way, about being like Greg Valentine, 15 minutes to warm up? That was just the intro. One of the things that he does so well, I think, and one of the things that I think makes him unique is that he is very, listening to a distributor's video is almost like being at a confessional or something. It's like he's intimately sharing some part of himself, some real part of himself. Bearing his soul, if you want, and it kind of gives you very often he'll start with a personal anecdote like the one we've just listened to, and this kind of helps get you invested in something that's non-political, that's something that is just part of this guy's life, you know. And then what he'll do is he will use that anecdote, that emotional hook, if you want, to weave in some deeper and more profound point that he wants to make. And this one of the reasons I picked this video out is that it has exactly this structure that Dave does so often. And I think, you know, when people really start getting into distributors' videos, it is this quality, this personal quality that puts him kind of, because it hits you in a different way. You know, it's not an intellectual point. It's, there is an intellectual content there, don't get me wrong. But it's kind of, it's reaching you, it's hitting you in a different part of the brain, if you want, or it's hitting you in the feels or something like this. This is why I have put Dave, I'm actually kind of interested where he goes with this. So let's watch a little bit more and then we'll, okay. You see, even though all he's done is told us this story about these Magic the Gathering cards and a violin, I'm kind of curious to know where he goes with it now. Right. And there is that, this is another kind of the slow reveal of where he's going is another, I think, Dave-ism or distributist-ism or whatever. So let's watch a little bit more.
At the beginning of this series, we started with the problem of nostalgia, and in particular, identities built around nostalgia. The problem that seemed to dwell at the heart of nostalgia was the recursive and inward-looking nature of the entire affair. We like these products because we consume them in our childhood, we consume them in our youth, and therefore they give our lives a sense of meaning, strictly for autobiographical reasons. Many times nostalgia doesn't point to anything of greater truth or goodness because that's not what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be self-referentially valid. Good not because it tells or alludes to a greater story, but because imbuing it with a mythical quality will vicariously imbue your own life with mythical meaning. Here, obviously, we could talk about Jeremy, my own affinity for Magic the Gathering, but we could also point to Thought Slime's own affinity for bad horror movies and cheap Power Ranger knockoffs. In fact, most of the cultural content you experience in YouTube is built on just this kind of self-referential narcissism. I probably don't have to hearken back to Nostalgia Critic, Nostalgic Chick, and That Guy with the Glasses. Half of the fun of watching a Noah Antweiler or a Doug Walker was remembering how bad the product you used to consume was, and still feeling kind of good about.
This is another thing about Dave. He's got a very long internet memory. He always remembers internet shit that people have forgotten about as well. So he's kind of good in that way. So I'll give it another couple of minutes and then we'll go on to number three.
Consuming it. It was being made part of a story, and part of a story that only you could really interact with. This is a mode that our generation in particular feels very comfortable with, and very comfortable repeating again and again and again. It seems to trap the modern mind in a repeating mode, in what leftists like to call capitalist realism, and what rightists like to call modernity. We see it everywhere, from the 1980s motifs that are so common and popular on the right, to the 1970s camp and kitsch aesthetics that are favored by the left. And I'm not immune to this emotion. I'm not immune to this cultural reality at all. It does seem like we're living in a world that's an echo of another one. I remember recently watching a movie, Ford vs. Ferrari, with my wife. Being sort of a sucker myself for engineering movies, I thought it would be a good opportunity to leave the politics that seems inserted in all Hollywood movies these days and just go in for some car racing adventure fun. But when I watched the movie, I found myself less engrossed in the cars and more just fascinated by the world of America in the 1960s, of Michigan in the 1960s. Michigan is not a state that I feel unfamiliar with, but watching a snapshot of the era, even interpreted through the eyes of Hollywood, one sees a world that has more optimism, that has a sense of where it's going. And you can't help not wanting to go back to that place and to find something of the direction and meaning those characters and indeed all of America seem to have. Now,
so I'm going to stop it here, but you know, you can see that, you know, I would say the last thing I'll mention about Distributist that makes him great is that his essays do have this, you know, meandering quality in a way. Like there's a kind of, you know, like half thoughts will occur to him and, you know, he'll mention things along the way, but it may not be the final thesis. So it kind of keeps you waiting for the you know, the punchline at the end, but along the way, it's always really interesting. And I mean, I'm someone who typically likes things to be concise, to the point. You know, if you've read any of my books, you know, I try not to mess around at all. But there's a reason for that, which is I've never really been able to do that meandering thing that well myself in my own writing. But for whatever reason, Distributist is really good at it. He can keep you engaged while kind of, you know, taking a meandering path. And this video is, you know, any of his videos basically are a good example of that. It's a peculiar skill. And he definitely has it. I'm trying to think. I'm pretty much the only time I have ever been able to do something meandering was a kind of non-written thing. So it was not, I didn't actually write it. And that was when I did the, do you remember when I did the actual cigar stream when I just sat, smoked a cigar and talked for 2 hours? That's the only time I've ever done the kind of meandering thing that Dave is able to do on pretty much all of his things. So, all right, so let's move on now up the list. Dave was number four. Number three, you've guessed it, a lot of people have already mentioned him, is, well, I mean, the thing is that when you're in conversation with somebody, so when I'm like on Unpopular Opinions with D and whatnot, and the conversation can go, you know, different places, that is different from doing it as a written piece, as something that you prepare. You know, that is more spontaneous, I would say. So, you know, the live stream is a different thing. And again, obviously, you know, UO can go all over the place, which is one of the charms of that show. But it's the thing that Dave does is different from that. If that makes any sense. Anyway, the next person is Frame Games Radio. So let's watch one of his absolute classics. about Starbucks and the diversity industry.
Today, we are going to travel deep into the heart of the diversity industry, using the flashpoint of the most transparent neo-imperial multinational corporation on Earth, Starbucks. First, we're going to experience the three-act Shakespearean drama of what actually happened in the latest heist by the diversity industry. And then you're going to learn the life lessons about how it all works. Buckle up, there will be turbulence on this flight.
How may I help you?
Hi, I have two gentlemen at my cafe that are refusing to make a purchase or leave. I'm at the Starbucks at 18th and Spruce.
All right, please, I'll be on as soon as possible.
Thank you. Bye.
Over the weekend, a video went viral on social media featuring two black men, unidentified black men, who got arrested at a Starbucks. The story began when the two had gone to this particular Starbucks in Philly, and they were waiting for a real estate developer in order to have this meeting about possible investment opportunities. Now, the two had not purchased anything at the Starbucks. They were still waiting for the real estate developer to show up. And at one point, one of these men went up to a worker at Starbucks and asked for the bathroom key to use the restroom. At that point, the employee denied access to the bathroom and told them that they needed to leave because they hadn't purchased anything. When the two refused to leave, this worker called 911.
I'm not kidding, called 911, which is supposed to be reserved for emergencies, but nonetheless, six police officers showed up because, of course, it takes six police officers to deal with the situation, and the two got arrested.
Now, we're going to show you the video, or at least a portion of the video that went viral. It's received up to 9 million views this morning alone. I'm sure at this point it's gone way past 9 million. But with that said, take a quick look.
What did they get called for? Because there are two black guys sitting here meeting me?
Yes, I didn't know.
Well, what did they do? What did they do? Did someone tell me what they did?
They didn't do anything. I saw the entire thing.
They didn't.
What did they do?
And the woman said it's for paying customers. They didn't do anything.
Let's not go through the whole thing, but if you watch it all, this video, which is an absolute classic, if you watch all the different parts of it, this Frame Games goes in forensic detail about every single aspect of this case, who the players were, how who the various pressure groups were, what the organization was, how exactly they did it, which NGOs were involved, specific pressure groups, specific names. And to me, in terms of people who have influenced me, and all of these people have influenced me in some way, when I was putting together the octopus, that was back before I knew the octopus was apparently an anti-Semitic trope, thanks Greta Thunberg, but I never heard of that before. But when I was putting that together, and when I was, again, trying to piece together how the entire system works, nobody shed more light on it than Frame Games. Now, these videos that I'm playing here of his are pretty old. Certainly, I think, really good. Let's see if we can move ahead a little bit. I'll play a little bit more. If we can get where he actually starts explaining some of this stuff, because I wanted to see if we just go forward a little bit here. Yeah, hold on.
Table space, your Wi-Fi, your amenities, and you will get nothing. The store manager was probably shocked and intimidated by my appalling attitude and my homeless appearance. She called the police because I was indeed trespassing. When the police arrived, I argued with them for 7 minutes, refusing to leave or buy something. Finally, I was detained, but ultimately not charged with anything. I'm probably going to make at least $1 million off of this, and the diversity industry behind me will likely get a $50 to $200 million payoff. But we'll get to that part later.
And Starbucks, by the way, really quickly, Cenk.
All right, so you get the idea. So yeah, he made excellent videos, and that is why he is number three. I think for Frame Games, one of why is he so high is because he actually gave a lot of practical information about how the system actually works in reality, in situ, in practice. And possibly that came from his actual real life experiences. I think Frame Games is a lot. He's actually shows his face now. I forget what his name is. He ended up working for Trump, and now he's on Twitter. He's had some fairly good kind of takes I've seen recently about the whole conflict in the Middle East and so on. But I would consider every single video he made back when he was Frame Games Radio, essential viewing. That goes pretty much for everybody I've listed here. You know, their entire, if you just watch their video, their edited videos, it would be like a kind of education within and of itself. Okay. So, that's his name. His name is Mike Benz now. I think he's pretty open about, his past and so on and so forth. But back in the day, he was Frame Games, and it's the material he made back then that has made him so high on this list. So number two on the list, you've been waiting for this one. I think a lot of people have been, when I said I was going to do a stream on video essayists, I think a lot of people's minds would have gone straight to this person, given that the quality of their work back in the day was so high. This individual is still around, although I don't think he was banned from YouTube. All of his stuff is still on YouTube, but he decided for, ideological reasons to go over to Odyssey, I think, is where he does most of his stuff now. But like so many people, about 2 years ago, he just stopped making video essays and now mainly does streams, 3-4 hour streams, just like I do, in terms of the total package, doesn't get much better, folks. So let's have a little watch.
As much as the baby boomers fought to overturn and rebel against and eventually destroy the American culture that existed before them, one thing that I have always found interesting is how much these same champions of counterculture that sadistically dismembered their heritage and mocked every tradition their parents had gifted them would at the same time romanticize this same culture they worked so hard to undo. In the 1980s and 90s, there were a flurry of television shows and movies that seemed to acknowledge a yearning for something, a not so quiet acknowledgement of a loss that nobody could quite put their finger on, a bitter regret that was much more than anything that could be explained away by the phenomenon of nostalgia. While these homages to a paradise lost forever sometimes included, a little bit of ridicule of their favorite boogeyman, the puritanical patriarchy that always had been the thankless guardians of this now extinct culture, there did exist a recognition, a deep remorse even, that these were the good old days. One of the most popular examples was even called Happy Days. But unfortunately, Pandora's box had already been opened. The genie could not be stuffed back into the bottle. The monster that the baby boomers had unleashed would grow and mutate and seek to preserve itself, something it could never do if everyone was looking back and quietly asking themselves if perhaps, just maybe, they'd made a terrible mistake. After this period of longing that went on for about a decade, it wasn't that long before these fantasies had to be distorted, something that was easier to do once those who lived through the era grew old and the memories began to fade. After a while, the sadness began to turn into bitterness. And as one might expect, the yearning was replaced with mocking and ridicule, like a spurned lover who finally gets past the grief stage and as a coping mechanism has to convince themselves that there was nothing good about their ex that they once loved. They have to pervert every memory they had of their time together to fit this new narrative that they're better off without them, that they had simply outgrown them. But it wasn't just important for the baby boomers to forget and smear the past they had thrown away to help them survive and get on, although in a very real way, it was about self-preservation. You see, a new generation was growing up now, growing up in a completely different world. The new normal that had been created, crafted by the baby boomers, a world of broken homes, of a broken society filled with broken people. They had smashed everything with the hammer of revolution without ever bothering to rebuild anything in its place. And now this new generation, raised in the rubble and smoldering ashes of the baby boomers' devastating culture war, they were looking at these images of nuclear families with attentive and loving parents, affordable schools you could pay your tuition just by having a summer job at the corner store. The corner store that didn't have any bulletproof glass, and if you didn't have enough money to pay your bill, it was okay because everyone knew and trusted each other. They lived in communities with a shared culture and history. They knew each other by name. They didn't even lock their front doors. What's more, everyone was happy. And they were happy without drugs, without antidepressants, without casual sex. What would this new generation, exposed to these images, what would they think if they saw this time, this place that now seemed like some kind of mad utopia and realized that it was gone? Or more.
So, I mean, this then goes on. And he reviews the film Pleasantville and shows, basically how Pleasantville was boomer propaganda. One of the best things about Devon Stack, of course, is his visual style. His I would say possibly the best in terms of just flair, in terms of his editing skills and so on. Obviously, his delivery is quite good as well. But there are often in his videos extremely interesting and deep insights into the way propaganda works. And really, it's his movie reviews. It's his most of his most famous video essays were basically movie reviews, showing just how insidious and just how good a lot of the old propaganda was. This one always sticks in the mind for me, to the extent where I can still remember exactly where I was when I first watched this. I watched it on my old iPod in a gym. I was I was at the gym, working out and watching this with my watching this on the old treadmill or whatever. Always stuck with me, but pretty much all of his edited videos like this are absolutely essential. So if you haven't watched them all, you could lose a couple of days, maybe 3 or 4 days, just going through his old back catalog. Blackpilled, is also, I would say, interesting because he's kind of quite savage. You're right. He doesn't pull any punches at all. And as his name suggests, he has taken all of the pills. You know, or every issue, he kind of knows some of the deeper truths, let's just say. In fact, I hadn't listened since he went off YouTube. I hadn't really. I always forget to go over to Odyssey and listen to shows. Kind of bad like that. And he is not on any other platforms, as far as I know. It's just on Odyssey now. But I started listening to his coverage of the recent kind of Middle East conflict. I can't remember what the name of the stream was, something about Zionistas. And literally the first hour was him just completely eviscerating Ben Shapiro for an hour straight. It was fucking brilliant. It was just brilliant. It really was. So maybe I'll start listening to Black Pill more regularly again, because I kind of missed him. He's one of the people I don't know, never talked to him, never been on a stream with him, never tried to get in touch with him, really. But absolutely brilliant. And, you know, he could have easily been number one, I guess. But there's somebody whose videos I think are even better. And that person, if you hadn't guessed it already, if you don't know who number one is, you haven't been around long enough, because it's quite obviously my old friend, the Poet of the North.
Hello there, folks. So this last week I found myself distracted by two trends which at first seemed to have nothing to do with each other, but on closer inspection seemed to have everything to do with each other. The first was the American evacuation from Afghanistan, and the second was my attempt to wade through a 1 hour and 45 minute video by one of the flagship YouTube channels of the left, ContraPoints. It goes without saying that I wasn't watching ContraPoints for any sort of enjoyment. It's more that I want to know what the other side are up to. ContraPoints has been celebrated by the American mainstream and seems to sum up the zeitgeist as the establishment would like it. ContraPoints are sophisticated enough to appeal to the intellect of policy wonks in the State Department or presenters of CNN, but it still has that air of being non-mainstream because it's still on YouTube. As my friend the distributors pointed out, ContraPoints is to the mainstream left what Jordan Peterson was to the mainstream right. The difference is the mainstream left is hegemonic. ContraPoints sums up the American moment of the present era. The video, which I genuinely found a slog, was called Envy and explored the concepts of envy and jealousy from many philosophical and historical angles. But most of all, of course, it was from the perspective of a very wealthy trans person, for the YouTube algo, who probably knows a lot about envy and has many people envious of them, which ContraPoints would acknowledge. But then there's what SpongeBob SquarePants has to say on envy. What about the ancient Greeks? ContraPoints had fun repeatedly breaking the fourth wall and addressing the audience. In other words, stepping outside the format and looking back in from a meta perspective, and then continuing on with an exploration of Nietzschean slave morality and how it naturally produced envy, or was itself a creation of the envy of the weak, while at the same time calling Nietzsche an angry incel. In other words, what we're getting is a deconstruction of the concept of envy, and at the same time, a deconstruction of the way envy was conceptualized across cultural forms. And at the end of it all, after long, long 1 hour and 45 minutes, what's left over is nothing. There's no satisfaction, no catharsis, no meaning derived, and no conclusion, no happy ever after. What you have is narratives which give meaning to the world and tatters, but nothing to replace them with. Imagine a beautifully crafted violin which, with the right musician, can express something heavenly in music. The question then arises as to why the violin is so special. What makes it a violin? So then it has its strings snipped and the varnish melted, the wood sawn through and the neck snapped. Eventually, you may have found the answers. You may understand why its timbre was perfect and why that particular design absorbed sounds or reflected them so perfectly. The problem is, you don't have a violin anymore. You've just got junk. But all along the way, you've also had the temporary thrill of destruction, of breaking apart that which was. This is, of course, the modern left incarnate. Pick whatever issue you like. Identity, ethnicity, religion, sex, class. It doesn't really matter. They've already broken it apart and rendered it useless. They've reduced almost every concept you can imagine to junk and felt intelligent while they do so. It's one thing to have this on the periphery of the intellectual life of the nation or the civilization or the culture, but it's quite another when it becomes the dominant and all-encompassing ideology, because eventually the civilization ceases to have a reason to exist or to justify itself in any meaningful way. What this covers up, for a time anyway, what it uses to cover this up, is pomp and spectacle, the show, the diva who can't sing, or who might not even be a diva, but nevertheless puts on a bright and glossy pantomime to entertain as the meaning slips away. And it's here we can take a look at the symbolism of American collapse in Afghanistan and how it intersects, so to speak, with the hegemony of the so-called woke left. The narratives which justified the neocon wars on terror were basically freedom and capitalism over there means we can safely enjoy our freedom and capitalism over here. And this was sold to America's white Christian base as being an objective good because freedom rocks, and so does Burger King. It's a cynical pack of lies, but at least it has a coherent narrative. A genuine leftist position on this would be to call it capitalist imperialism. It was the West and white, supposedly, system colonizing the poorer parts of the world to extract resources for the profits of big business and also filling up the coffers of the military-industrial complex. The intervening decades haven't been kind to the traditional white conservative Christian base of America. In fact, judging from afar over here in England, it seems they have had a cultural and demographic war waged upon them by the entire capitalist system, as the left would usually frame it, to the degree that the system now sees them as much of a terrorist threat or subversive element as it does radicals from Afghanistan or the Middle East. But here's the problem. America's foreign wars and adventurism largely consisted of recruiting from the section of the population that was swiftly being erased, demonized, and told to check their privilege. The people who believed in the American dream would fight for that dream, and they did, but they were now on the out, politically, culturally, and demographically. And so this means the ideology people call woke, which has essentially become the replacement for American patriotism, now has to formulate a way of justifying imperialism abroad. But the problem with that is that wokeism is based on a negation of all things traditional and the lionizing of the marginalized of the world, except rural Americans who get to die quietly of opioid addiction. The beating heart of America is now a negation of itself. If America is the creation of racism, white supremacy and capitalism, as is claimed by the ascendant ideologues, then by what right can it claim to improve the lives of other people around the world? The short answer to that lies in social justice, the rainbow flag, in buzzwords such as tolerance and equality. As the Taliban took control of Kabul, shocked mouthpieces such as Vaush, another bread tuber who sums up the American moment, searched around for a coherent narrative, as did the rest of America's politically correct mandarins. If America is institutionally racist, if American foreign policy is imperialist, and you're against such things, then what is the American will or strategy on the world stage? If it defends those interests and the left-wing thinking that permeates American institution today supports it, then aren't they just perpetuating the system? How to get around the bind? How to put the shattered narrative back together? Well, I guess that's why we're getting so much talk of women's rights now. it at least fits into the social justice frame. Can it be enough to justify war and occupation? The first problem is the most basic one. If you've already abolished the foundations of your own civilization because they weren't politically correct enough, then what is it you're forcing onto the other people apart from what your civilization became? Especially when we consider that many of the dominant values in America today, such as the trans issue, weren't even considered by the mainstream when America invaded Afghanistan just 20 years ago. The second problem is, how do you socially engineer a country like Afghanistan to share your views of women, and what are those views on women, given that we're also supposed to believe misogyny is still a problem in the West anyway? Well, let us, for the sake of argument, say Western attitudes to women that we had in the 80s might be suitable for Afghanistan. Well, once again, aren't these the values of the culture that we in the present think of as being oppressive? Or is it to be second-wave feminism or third-wave feminism? And how is this to be done? Presumably, we'll have to change the religious and cultural mores forcibly, and there will also have to be a program of re-education for everyone in the country. And what will replace meaning and identity in this new Afghanistan, for example? Well, social justice, rainbow flags and corporate slogans, just like America has, just like the West has.
All right. I mean, it goes on, you know, this is about halfway through, but you kind of, you know, you get what he, you know, what he's driving at here. Why is Morgoth the number one? Why have I rated him number one? I mean, the first thing I'll say is he is a buddy of mine. And of all the people in this list, he's probably the one I am in closest contact with. You know, I probably talk to him every day. Pretty good mates with Charlie as well. Although I haven't talked to him much recently. But, you know, he's in... I speak to him fairly regularly as well. But I mean, either daily or bi-daily contact with Morgoth. But why is he the number one? Now, I would say that it's obvious that he doesn't have like the visual flair of some of the others. In terms of the, you know, it's not like kind of moving, like high tech moving images, and it doesn't have some of the kind of pizzazz of Blackpilled or Krogan, say, but I think that what he does have is an incredible way, and this is the reason I call him the poet of the North, by the way. His mind works in a different way from a normal person, right? There's this old essay by T.S. Eliot. I forget exactly. Maybe it's T.S. Eliot writing about John Donne. And he's basically trying to explain what makes a poet versus like a normal writer. What makes an artist an artist? And T.S. Eliot talks about the ability of taking disparate things that are seemingly unconnected, and seeing a connection there that nobody else can see, kind of putting things together that you wouldn't expect to go together. And this is something I think Morgoth always does. And he kind of, it's like a kind of discovered, it's almost like if you ever play chess, in chess you can have something called a discovered check. You know, like, you know, the knight is there, you move the knight, and, you know, the bishop is behind, and now you've discovered a check on the king because the bishop is behind. And all of Morgoth's videos have this amazing quality of a discovered check, something that is there in broad daylight, but it's not obvious until you see it. So these are all things, I think, that make Morgoth number one, because I just don't know anyone else who can do that. It is remarkable. He also has an amazing way of making an analogy as well. He can draw and he can kind of capture something about the present moment in an image, like he did with that broken violin. So all of these things, I think, are what make Morgoth number one in terms of specifically in terms of being a video essayist. He also, I think, gets at things at a profound level. So there's like on any given issue, there's like the level one take, the level two take, the level three take. Morgoth always seems to find a way to get underneath all of those takes to, you know, get at something really profound and fundamental. So, yeah, I mean, just phenomenal. And I actually met Morgoth same time as I met Dave at the event earlier this year. And in real life, he's just exactly as you'd imagine him to be. I kind of joked afterwards saying that he would make, like, if you were making an RPG, he would be the perfect like tavern keeper or something in the RPG, you know. He's just got that kind of, like, his physiognomy and his kind of general vibe is very much, you know, very much as you'd imagine. So, and I think that obviously plays into things as well. But anyway, he is absolutely something. I would say a special talent. So there it is. I've put over the 10 people on the list. I tried to pick out videos that kind of showed them at their best. Although obviously, you know, when it comes to Morgoth, he's got so many great videos. You know, there's one that always stands out to me where he talks about, the whale? I seem to remember that one. There's obviously his Archetypes of the Left, the Hatchling and all of that. And there are some other ones as well that kind of stand out. You know, when he talks about Spengler, some of his ones about technology have been amazing as well. So yeah, I mean, you know, pretty much, his review of Heat, he's good on movies as well, Morgoth. So yeah, his Heat video is also one that really stands out to me. Another really, the one that actually brought him to my attention was, do you remember I used to have that slogan, you know, if you're pushing out an open door, you are not a radical. Do you remember all of that? Morgoth back in the day did a video where he was having a go at Stormzy, and Morrissey picked up the video, and like Morrissey retweeted the video, and it kind of got Morrissey into trouble, and Morrissey was like, you know, Morrissey's base, so he just kind of didn't back down or anything. And basically this video of Morgoth was pointing out that Stormzy is a fucking fake, that he is just a creature of the regime, that he is a regime idea of what is edgy and cool, and therefore is not, you know, basically not a radical because he's pushing at an open door. And I'm pretty sure that was the first, that was when, I don't know if it was the first video of his I ever watched, but it was probably the one which made me think, I have to get in touch with this guy, you know. So yeah, that Stormzy video stands out in my mind as well, just being particularly insightful. So yeah, I mean, that is, he's got many others as well. So yeah, I mean, these were my top 10. This is my top 10, the people who've had the most impact on me and my kind of development as I have been on YouTube. And the people I've kind of enjoyed watching the most and learned the most from. But you may have your own list. You know, there are many great video essayists who I didn't include on the list that, you know, could have easily made another person's top 10. You know, Way of the World used to make great videos back in the day. There was a guy called, what was his name? The Iconoclast. He made great videos back in the day. My old buddy, Daughter of Albion, she made great videos back in the day. I mean, these are all people who are good at this. So there are other people who I could have included. But for me, on balance, these 10 I put, you know, Aura McIntyre makes good videos. You know, many, many other people, many, and, you know, friends of mine as well. But for me, these are the 10. So, you know, maybe for fun, you could put your own top 10, you know, and you don't have to include me. As I said at the start, I'm not sure if a video essay is my particular forte, or even the written essay. I've never been much of an essayist, you know. I kind of write books. I write books. I've written more books than I have essays in terms of, you know, stuff like properly published out there. Although I do the Substack and so on. But, you know, anyway, hope you enjoyed this. So something a little bit different. I buy my courses, of course. Something I am good at is teaching people stuff, I hope. Pick up the Trivium, join the channel, subscribe to my Substack. But most importantly of all, ladies and gentlemen, get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.